From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Today, House Republicans unveiled a tax cut plan they're calling the Tax Cut and Jobs Act, choosing that name for the 429-page plan instead of the name President Trump reportedly wanted, which was the Cut, Cut, Cut Act. Here's House Speaker Paul Ryan.
With this plan, the typical family of four will save $1,182 a year on their taxes. For many families, having an additional $1,182 more will make a real difference.
It was a long slog getting to this point. Joining us, NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson. Hi, Mara.
Hi there.
I say long slog, but we're reminded under President Reagan in 86, it took years and was a bipartisan plan. This time it's a Republican plan. And they had to cut taxes while not raising the deficit in order to avoid a filibuster. So does the plan at first blush, as Republicans say, benefit, you know, families, or does it, as Democrats claim, give a windfall to the rich?
Well, I think the rich are probably the biggest winners in this plan, but it definitely gives benefits to families. Maybe some families would see their taxes go up, but they are planning to double the standard deduction, which will help families. On the other hand, if you live in one of those blue states where they have high state and local taxes, you're not going to get to deduct them anymore from your tax bill. You're going to get, I think, up to $10,000 of property taxes that you can deduct.
Actually, I'm going to ask you to stay there because that's been so controversial. Republicans were under a lot of pressure from some Republicans, especially in the Northeast, to keep these deductions for state and local taxes. So again, how'd that play out?
That's right. Well, so there are going to be some deductions, but it's going to be scaled back. So I think the losers are people in blue states where state and local taxes tend to be higher than red states. Blue states tend to pay more in taxes to the federal government than they get back in services. And there are a lot of Republicans from New Jersey and California and New York who don't like this. And the National Association of Home Builders has already come out against it because it's going to limit the deduction of mortgage interest. And the realtors don't like this either. But there are other groups that are happy about it. For instance, 401ks are not going to be touched. That's something that the tax writers had considered, but they're not going to do that. So the point is, behind every loophole, there's a lobbyist. And in order to pay for the cost of this tax bill, you have to get rid of some loopholes. And that's where the big fight is going to be.
Okay. Well, we'll take that up again in a second. But on the to-do list, corporations will go from 35% to 20. Both Democrats and Republicans have wanted the taxes on corporations to be lowered, so more of that money is in this country,
right,
not overseas.
Right.
But where, given that cut and the fact that President Trump, as you said, did prevail, no changes to the 401 plan contributions, that would have taxed more savings on the front end when you put money away instead of on the other end when you take it out. That's gone away. But where are Republicans making up for this, the lack of tax money coming in?
Well, first of all, they're allowing a $1.5 trillion addition to the deficit. That was in the budget. But what they're doing is, as I said, they're going to limit deductions for mortgage interest. They're going to get rid of the personal exemption, even though they're doubling the standard deduction for families. I think that might hurt families with a lot of children. They are raising the child tax credit by $600. And of course, they're making state and local taxes less deductible. So that's where they're getting some of that. They're also phasing in some of these tax cuts to make it comply with the budget rules. Mm. Because if you, and some of these are also going to be temporary. That also allows them to stick under the budget rules, which means they get to pass this with only Republican votes. Democrats cannot filibuster it in the Senate.
And is that going to happen? What happens next?
What happens next is the president says he wants a tax plan passed by the House by Thanksgiving, and he wants the whole thing on his desk by Christmas. That's been described to me as a timetable that's somewhere between ambitious and insane. Mm-hmm. But what happens next is the lobbyists go to their corners. They try to protect their favored loopholes. And the president and his allies, I think, are going to spend $100 million in advertising pushing for this. The president's going to go around the country, try to pressure red state Democrats who are up for re-election in 2018 to vote for this. And the details are going to change. My prediction is this probably will die 1,000 deaths. But in the end, something will pass. Maybe it won't even be this big and broad and sweeping kind of tax reform. Maybe it'll be just a more more modest set of tax cuts. But I think that Republicans are under so much political pressure to pass something, especially since they couldn't repeal and replace Obamacare. They don't want to go home to voters empty-handed next year. So I think that, you know, the if you're a betting person, you'd bet that something, some kind of tax cuts, maybe even tax reform, will pass, maybe early next year.
And just so briefly, will it be because Republicans don't like it? That's why it'll die 1,000 deaths?
Well, different kinds of Republicans from different states don't like it, and different interest groups don't like it, and that's why it'll die 1,000 deaths. But I do think if Republicans can't pass tax cuts, something that's deep in their DNA, I don't know what else they could pass. So I think for that reason and the political pressure, I think something will pass.
NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson, thanks.
Thank you.
Well, as the opioid crisis continues to escalate, many states offer immunity to people who call an overdose into 911. If they're also using drugs, they won't be arrested because that 911 call may have saved a life. Well, Arizona does not have a law like that, but it may soon. Will Stone from KJZZ in Phoenix reports.
When Brett Morrison got a phone call from his mother saying there was a warrant for his arrest, he was puzzled.
Like, what did I do? I have no idea what I did.
What he had done was call 911 more than a year ago. He was using heroin back then, as he had for years, when the guy who sold him the drugs overdosed.
Cops came. They asked me, how do you know he's overdosing on heroin? I said, because I took it and I flushed it down the toilet, not thinking anything of it.
The police were able to save the man's life with the overdose reversal drug naloxone. Then,
a year later, I get a charge called hindering prosecution.
And I thought, how can you get arrested for calling 911? I had no idea that this kind of thing was happening.
That's Brett's mother, Janice Morrison, a retired high school teacher. Brett wanted to fight the charge, but he was already on probation and had gone to prison for selling pot, meaning if he lost his case,
I would have gone to prison because of this. So therefore, I had to sign a plea agreement.
He ended up with probation, but no jail time. This situation happens a lot, says Janice, who's in a support group for families dealing with addiction. And many times, out of fear of prosecution, she says no one calls 911 for help.
You just hear it over and over and over, and people should never, ever, ever, never hesitate to call 911 for any reason, I think. You cannot get that person into recovery if that person is dead.
She knows because Brett, who's now 35 years old, is sober and working in the recovery industry. And he doesn't blame anyone for the incident. He was using drugs, after all.
It did hold me accountable. However, it's about saving this person's life, the only thing that matters at that moment.
Lawmakers in Arizona have tried unsuccessfully for years to pass what's known as a 911 Good Samaritan law. It would ensure someone who calls 911 because of a drug-related overdose cannot be charged for possession or use of a controlled substance.
I introduced that bill 2 years ago. It did not receive a committee hearing.
That's Dr. Randy Freese, a Democratic state lawmaker from Tucson.
Do I think Arizona's even close to that? No. We need the political pressure on the majority to begin to say this could be a solution that saves lives.
And the timing for that solution may be ripe. Governor Doug Ducey has made the opioid epidemic a major priority, declaring a statewide emergency. In September, state health officials released an ambitious plan to reduce opioid-related deaths by 25% in the next 5 years. One of the top recommendations? A 911 Good Samaritan law. But this approach still challenges the philosophy of some conservatives in Arizona's law enforcement community. Sheila Polk is the top prosecutor in Yavapai County, where Brett Morrison was charged.
Is this a feel-good band-aid that doesn't really accomplish what we want to see accomplished, which is people embracing sobriety and living a path of productivity as opposed to encouraging further drug use and making it easier to use drugs?
Polk says people in her community aren't pushing for a law that gives drug users immunity.
Instead, what I hear from a lot of people is it's actually that contact with the criminal justice system that presents them with the hammer and the stick.
And as for the claim that people are dying because no one wants to call during an overdose,
I don't know that folks who are using heroin or have overdosed on heroin are even in that frame of mind.
A study published in the National Bureau of Economic Research found little evidence that Good Samaritan laws increase recreational use of prescription painkillers. And while the researchers cannot prove these laws on their own reduce overdose deaths, they said the estimated effects are large.
In fact, it's literally the least that we can do.
Greg Rosenstein is the incoming president of Arizona Attorneys for Criminal Justice. He says Arizona lags behind other states on drug policy reform, making users more fearful of law enforcement.
We have a state that has very draconian mandatory minimum sentencing, so people are legitimately looking at prison time, and we don't want anything to dissuade them from calling for help.
There's no new legislation on the table yet, but some state lawmakers, Republicans included, say they're considering it. A spokesperson for the governor says he's open to the idea and will need to hear more before taking a position. Janice Morrison is already gearing up to make her case for the law again.
This is right now our number one health crisis. It has surpassed car accidents, so something has to be done.
On that, there's broad consensus. For Here and Now, I'm Will Stone in Phoenix.
This is Here and Now. Tomorrow, President Trump leaves for a lengthy trip to Asia, where he will visit Japan, South Korea, China, Vietnam, and the Philippines. It'll be a chance for Trump to reaffirm America's regional alliances and press China on trade issues. The visit also comes just after China's leader, Xi Jinping, announced that China was ready to take center stage in the world. Gideon Rachman, who is chief foreign affairs columnist for the Financial Times, wrote a book earlier this year called Easternization, Asia's Rise and America's Decline. We spoke in April, and I asked him about that premise. Has it happened yet?
Yeah, I think it has. I mean, obviously, people have been preoccupied by the rise of Asia on and off for many years. But I think you could look at the Obama years as a moment when quite important things happened. So that, for example, in 2014, the IMF came out with a ranking of the world's largest economies. And for the first time ever, they said that China, at least ranked by purchasing power, which is one way of doing it, is now the largest economy in the world. And in other ways, in the last 10 years, China's become the largest manufacturer in the world, the largest exporter in the world. And it's part of a broader phenomenon of growing Asian power. So in that ranking the IMF came up with, of the four top nations, three were in Asia. China, the US was second, and then there was Japan and India. And so the economic center of gravity of the world, I think, has now pretty clearly moved towards the Asia Pacific.
Does it matter, though, that the US is still the biggest military power?
Oh, sure, it does. Absolutely. And I think it sets up a tension because the US is still clearly the biggest military power, and it's also the biggest political power. It's the only superpower in the world. That's been that case ever since the fall of the Berlin Wall. And the question really that the book wrestles with in different ways is, how is this mismatch between the shift of economic power towards Asia, how is that going to play out against the background of a world in which, in political and military terms, the US is still number one? How is the adjustment of political power going to play out?
Well, you point out in this book that China is constantly just pushing boundaries to see how far it can go. And I wonder, how does China react when countries push back? Do they back off or do they stand firm?
It depends which country, to be honest. I think increasingly the Chinese have been learning that they can push around almost anybody except the United States. But that doesn't mean that they are prepared to defer to America. It just means that they will be a bit more subtle in the way that they use their power, so that they've advanced through sort of little steps in the South China Sea, building up their territorial claims. They certainly don't accept America's naval operations there, but they've tried to avoid direct confrontation. Whereas with other countries, smaller countries, it's much more evident that China now is really willing to throw its weight around.
Let's talk about numbers, because you cite an estimate that by 2025, two-thirds of the world's population will live in Asia, whereas the U.S. will be 5% of the world's population, the EU 7%. How important are the sheer numbers of population? Can you be the superpower in the world for a long time if you have such a smaller population than another country?
Well, I think that the weight of population does matter now much more than it did in the past. Because in the old days, the wealth gap between the advanced Western nations, and particularly the US, but also the Western Europeans and Asia, was so huge that it didn't really matter that, you know, there were hundreds of millions of Chinese, now 1.4 billion 1.3 billion Indians because they were very poor. So the Chinese economy, the Indian economy, was still smaller. That economic gap has narrowed. So the average Chinese is now about probably only about 25% as rich as the average American. But when you have that population, cumulatively, the economy is larger or as large, depends on the unit of measurement you want to use. And the same goes for India, which was a very poor country. There's still many people living in absolute poverty in India, but because they've been on the move economically, growing at 8, 9, 10% a year, they are now a big economy. But in response to your question about, well, can America continue to be the superpower? Yes, for a while, because it has other assets. It has allies, for example. There is such a thing as the Western Alliance. There is no Eastern Alliance. Asia's very, very divided. And that's really the key to American power in Asia, is that a lot of the Asian countries don't necessarily side with China. In fact, they're very scared of China, and they want the U.S. to stay a presence in the region. And Trump, for example, has been very wary of allies, regards them as exploiting America's security guarantees, regards countries like Japan and South Korea as almost as bad on trade as the Chinese. So there is that. And then I think the other thing is that there's a big question about American will. Would America really fight over rocks in the South China Sea? Would it really fight to protect outlying bits of territory of Japan? And as long as the Chinese can plant doubts about that, and some of Trump's rhetoric reinforces those doubts, then there's always a question mark to America's allies in the region. You know, is America really going to be there if the push comes to shove? There was quite a good line a Singaporean said to me, is that he said, yeah, of course we want America to stay, but we know that China will still be our neighbor in 1,000 years' time. But we don't know if America will still be a big Pacific power in 100 years' time.
If you're just tuning in, we're speaking with Gideon Rockman, who is chief foreign affairs commentator for the Financial Times. His new book is Easternization, Asia's Rise and America's Decline, From Obama to Trump and Beyond. And Gideon Rockman, we have to talk about India, because India is the second most populous country after China. But China, as you point out in this book, is clearly very worried about India. They have created basically a ring of port cities from China all the way down to Africa to make sure that they've got the routes that they need to get the resources that they need getting around India. And then this is something I didn't realize, that the Chinese are helping out Pakistan as much as possible in order to give India some trouble.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly what the Indians think. And I think they're increasingly worried by it, because you said that the Chinese are worried by the Indians, and they are a bit. But I think the Indians are even more worried about the Chinese, because they're that much further behind. And the Indians feel that the Chinese are trying to contain them partly by supporting their old adversary, Pakistan. It's pretty certain that the Pakistani nuclear program got some aid from China. And actually, China has a certain vulnerability because a lot of its oil comes from the Middle East. It has to come a long way around. Chinese have basically sponsored the building of a very large port in Pakistan, which gives them a much shorter route to get the oil. So there's big infrastructure routes being built right across Pakistan to China. And then there's the other question, whether, as you remarked, China's also building up other alliances. It's got very close to Sri Lanka, which is the island nation at the bottom of India. It's built ports there. It's built ports in Burma. So if you kind of took a geostrategic look at the map, you would think, if you were Indian, there's almost what they call a string of pearls being built around us that they might one day tighten around our neck.
Well, it reminds you, even in the 21st century, that shipping is still really important to power.
I know. It's incredible, isn't it? Yeah, it feels very 19th century, doesn't it, that people should still be worrying about sea routes and so on. But it does matter, because oil, to be blunt, I mean, America's slightly alleviated its problem because of the shale gas thing. So America's less dependent on Saudi oil than it used to be. China, however, is very dependent on oil from both Saudi Arabia and Iran. And one of the paradoxes of world affairs now is that the Straits of Hormuz, through which all this oil passes, are kept open by the U.S. Navy. And both sides think that's a bit peculiar. The Americans are thinking, why are we basically providing China security for it? And the answer to that, of course, is I spoke to Americans about this, and they thought, well, we have thought maybe we could pull out. But then how would we feel if actually the Chinese Navy was patrolling the Persian Gulf? And I think the Chinese, on the one hand, think it's great. that they don't have to have this commitment in the Gulf, which comes with all sorts of complications to it. On the other hand, it makes them feel a bit vulnerable because they think, well, actually, the American Navy is all along the route that our oil comes through. It's in the Gulf where the oil comes starts coming through, but then it's also by the Malacca Straits where it has to continue, which is this very narrow strait of water, the busiest waterways in the world between Singapore, Malaysia, and Indonesia. And again, the U.S. Navy is based in Singapore, or rather operates out of Singapore. So the Chinese have what they call a Malacca Strait dilemma. They think, look, if there was ever a conflict, we could be in real trouble there.
So what would your one piece of advice to the Trump administration be to try to stop the Easternization of the world?
I would say you can't stop it. You're not going to be able to go back to the era in which America dominated both the global economy and dominated the global political scene. But that needn't be a disaster if you can, through a kind of judicious mix of policies, accept the inevitability of the rise of China, but then try to manage it so that you set some rules both for the global economy and you keep your alliances firm in Asia, but not so firm that you actually slide into a confrontation with China. Now, that's not an easy balance to strike,
right?
But it is the one that I think successive administrations in different ways have ended up with. It's sort of what the Bush administration was doing. It's what the Obama administration was doing. And I think any administration, even one whose rhetoric is quite as radical as that of Donald Trump's, when they look at the set of choices facing America, will probably end up, if they're sensible, with something similar, which tries to emphasize cooperation where you can, but set some guidelines and some lines for China on the use of force and on how it treats its neighbors. It's a fine balance to strike, but I don't think it's impossible.
That's Gideon Rockman of the Financial Times. His book is called Easternization, Asia's Rise and America's Decline. We spoke with him in April. President Trump takes his first trip as president to Asia tomorrow, and we've got an excerpt from the book at hereandnow.org.
Houston Astros fans, as for the first time in team history, the Astros won the World Series last night in Los Angeles. The Los Angeles Dodgers had the best record in Major League Baseball this season, but went home empty-handed after a 5-1 loss in Game 7. Mike Pesca is here now, sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. LA had the best record, but Houston had George Springer.
George Springer was the MVP, and after going 0-for-4 in Game 1 and having tons of strikeouts, he just said to himself, wait a minute, I'm George Springer. I'm one of the most gifted athletes in this game. I'm also a highly skilled player, a number one pick, and he hit home runs, and he had game-winning hits, and he's just an excellent outfielder. That never abates. So, yes, George Springer is one of but many reasons that the Astros were able to beat this great Dodgers team. And, you know, the Astros also had 100 wins, as we discussed last week. It was the first meeting between 200-win teams in the World Series since 1970, and it really was a great series.
Well, so last night, Houston jumped way out. Springer had a 2-run homer, became the first player in the World Series to homer in 4 consecutive games. L.A. never caught up. What do you think was happening?
Okay, there is an excellent piece of evidence as provided by an analyst from ESPN who was looking at Yu Darvish. He's the starting pitcher for the Dodgers. He was looking at his glove, and he was noticing that this is Eduardo Perez, who's the ESPN analyst and former major leaguer. He was noticing that Darvish was what's called tipping his pitches so that the Astros could figure out if a curveball was coming or more likely if a fastball or a slider was coming. And that alone could explain why Darvish is the first pitcher in 50 or so years not to make it out of the second inning in 2 games of the World Series. I mean, Darvish is a really good pitcher, but the Astros were all over his pitches, and the game was over by the time he left the mound in the second. And one of the theories is because through advanced scouting and guile, they kind of knew it was coming.
Yeah, but how great was this series?
It was really good. I mean, it wasn't great for the pitchers. There was a lot of complaints about the balls and the grip and were you able to, spin your curveball? But it was, there was a ton of offense. We saw a game that was 13-12 that was, just mind-boggling in terms of how many comebacks there were. And maybe we're a little spoiled by last year, Cubs and Indians, but it is quite rare for a series to go to a seventh game. This is the first Game 7 in the history of the L.A. Dodgers, which seems mind-boggling given how often they've been in the World Series.
A lot of the word heartbroken was used a lot in social media referring to the Dodgers. But, of course, Houston has come through the terrible flooding, so this has double meaning there. But looking forward, you know, this was the year of the home run. Does that continue?
I think so, because no matter, maybe they'll restore the ball if there is indeed a problem with the ball to pre-2017 levels. But major leaguers are just swinging with uppercuts. They're swinging for the fences and they're making the fences. And there were a couple of extra factors. The temperature was so hot in L.A. that balls were just bouncing out of the ballpark. I think we're in a home run and strikeout era. And I think the Astros are well poised to take advantage of that era.
Astros and L.A., thank you both. It was just so much fun to watch. And thank you, Mike Pesca, Here Now sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Thanks, Mike.
You're welcome.
In the opening of the new play, Stuffed, four women crawl out of kitchen appliances onto the stage and begin talking about their bodies. Too fat, too thin, anorexic, and overweight, but okay with that. How much does one woman love food? Well, she'd push Zoe Barnes in front of a train, Frank Underwood style, rather than give it up, a House of Cards reference, and a line written by biting comedian Lisa Lampanelli. See what I did with that biting thing? Who's also one of the stars. It's a chorus line without the music, but with giant refrigerators, game shows, every weight reference known to women and some men, sleep eating Oreos, hating Lululemon yoga pants, salads to which they add bacon and sour cream until it's the size of a sombrero, binges. Lisa talks about eating a half bucket of raw cookie dough from Sam's Club in front of the TV, which isn't even on. Lisa Lampanelli plays herself alongside three other talented actors in Stuffed, which opened this week and runs through mid-February at the West Side Theater in New York. And playwright, comedian, and now actor Lisa Lampanelli joins us from the NPR studios in New York. Welcome.
Hello, darling. Thank you so much for having me. I feel so classy being on NPR. I used to listen to Car Talk all the time.
Oh, I'm sure. Because, you know.
I love those guys.
Well, we love them more than anyone, but they'd be the first to say classy, not us. Let's talk about you. You're known as a no-holds-barred Joan Rivers-style comedian. You say in the play that the genesis of it is when you finally found your place in the world on the stand-up stage. You did an act one night. You killed. Your brother was there. He was so proud of you. You're watching another comic who's absolutely bombing. You're feeling for him. But then, read from your play, what happens?
So I'm standing in the back of the room, racking my brains, trying to think of something nice I can say to poor Jim when he gets off stage to make him feel better about himself, when all of a sudden I hear, "Hey, this guy sucks. Bring back the fat chick." And I'm like, "Fat? Wait, fat? No, come on. I'm not fat tonight. I'm funny tonight. I'm not fat tonight." Fat is the worst word ever.
Yeah. But then,
yeah, that really stung. It really stung. Even if I had good self-esteem, I would have heard the bring back part.
Yeah. And it's also, you had a break. You had a little break there for a minute from that sense of yourself.
Yes. Yeah.
Right. Well, tell us, what is your sense of yourself and your weight? Give us the thumbnail on you.
Well, now I'm lucky enough that I have had gastric sleeve surgery 5 years ago and kept off my weight 5 years. But it's been a daily struggle, first of all, to keep it off and also to like what I see from the neck down. I mean, we're very conditioned in the world to think we're less than when it comes to looks or career or anything. And I think the self-acceptance part had to be pointed out in the play, which is why we have the character of Marty, who actually likes who she is.
Yeah.
Me, I'm still at the point where I'm, you know, I kind of 90% of the time I think I'm fine. And but it's always work. I don't think we're ever going to not be working on this.
Well, but you work through it in the play when we get to hear, you know, the stations of the cross of weight loss, you know, that you go through. I mean, there's a whole segment on jeans, for instance.
Oh, yes. Yes. I mean, honestly, whoever invented blue jeans definitely needs to be killed.
Yeah.
I mean, they never looked good on a woman other than a French woman, and nobody likes them anyway.
So you and your characters talk about, you know, how the mental preparation for putting on a pair of jeans, if you've had a bagel or, as you say, a Tic Tac.
Yes.
They're not going to fit.
It's really funny how I think what I did was, over the course of my life, I think I struggled with my weight from when I was 18 years old up until the weight loss surgery and now continuing on. And I go, some good has to come from all this crazy knowledge I have and all these struggles. So I was like, well, a play that other people can relate to. Yeah, this is what's right for me. So it's all those crazy things about jeans and, oh God, salads and eating and all the diets in the world.
The scale!
Oh my God, dude, I had to weigh myself 2 days ago. And the day you have to step on the scale, you go insane. It's like, I make sure I pee like 8 times. I make sure I never eat a crumb or have a sip of water before I get on that scale. It's literally insanity. And every woman seems in the audience to be able, and some of the men actually, seem to be able to relate to these kind of things that are all common to a lot of us.
The scale, doubly psychic, because it can predict your weight and also what kind of day you're going to have.
I have the worst day ever. If I gain 0.4 pounds, I'm like, you know what? I'm going to have to stay home in bed.
Some of the other characters, Brittany, played by Eden Malin from House of Lies and Orange is the New Black, is the bulimic, anorexic, 87-pound woman at one time beaten by her boyfriend. Mm-hmm. And all she can think about while she's being attacked by him is that she hasn't yet purged the bagel that she ate. She's timing it to try to purge the bagel that she had before it becomes a part of her. I mean, just
Yeah. I mean, that character is really interesting because I talked to a bunch of anorexic girls or who had been anorexic in the past or bulimic. And that voice, that the food voice you have in your head about get rid of that food, don't allow yourself to digest anything. It's really present in these women for long, and men too. And I wanted to really capture the voice of, wow, what people go through when they are really, really deep in this kind of disease.
Yeah. Well, and Lisa, you also relate another story about Frank, your 400-pound boyfriend.
Yes, for, Big Frank.
For a time, also a comic, a diabetic who wasn't caring for himself enough, and you couldn't take that and broke up. And you share a terrible ending. I mean, he died.
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, it's so wild because I had dated him for a while. He was clearly going to be the love of my life. And eventually, every person has to come to the decision of, do I have to save him or do I have to save me? And I have to make that choice. And as you know, when you're in an airplane and they say, put your oxygen mask on first and then help the person you're with, that's the order it has to go in.
Yeah.
So with Frank, I know he's looking down, laughing and saying, wow, I live on here, because he was so funny and so much fun. And it's great to memorialize someone like that because he did have a big impact on my life, or I would never have changed my ways.
Yeah. Well, but so there's these, you know, deep, deep feelings expressed. There's the girl who can't gain weight.
Yes.
Who it's just as powerful for her as someone who can't lose weight. But then did you ever question, and I already know the answer to this because you're Lisa Lampanelli.
Yes.
And did you ever question the comedy part, you know, around the scales, you know, if we get a great weight, we're going to get married, pass the bar, win the lottery, win the Hamilton ticket lottery.
Yes, you know. Well, you know, I had started writing this as a one-person show with Alan Zweibel, who wrote Billy Crystal's 700 Sundays with him. So he's a pro, worked on Saturday Night Live for years. And he said to me, when I told him, what if it's not funny enough? He said, I'll tell you what I told Billy Crystal. You can't help but do a show that's funny. Get the real on the page first, and then the funny will find itself. So those funny moments just come up, especially, as you say, the first sort of 60% of the play is really punchline heavy and funny stories and bizarre things happening and crazy devices on stage. But then when you hear their sad or bottom stories that are ultimately hopeful, you go, wow, this is funny and touching. I didn't expect that, which it was so fantastic that it actually happened. So all I had to do was not worry about the funny because it had to come.
Yeah. And I'm thinking, too, again, when these women talk about how they're going to get the perfect weight, and then they'll shop at farmers markets and buy fresh flowers and speak in a whisper, and everyone will lean in to hear me because I am the perfect weight. The other thing the play reinforces is that You don't even know that those women who you think are perfect with the perfect weight, wearing black cigarette pants and crisp white button-down shirts that never wrinkle because they are the perfect weight, you don't know how they feel about their
Thank
bodies.
Thank you. I yeah. love that you said that because there are women walking around New York City who I look at and I go, oh, my God, she's perfect. Oh, my God, she's so lucky. She's so lucky. Guess what? You never know what that person's going through. And I've talked to women who I think are just the ideal. Like, they look like Audrey Hepburn. And they say, oh, my God, my thighs are too big, or, oh, my God, my stomach's too big. And I'm going, wow, we all do this to ourselves. I know maybe 3-4 people in my life in 56 years who really like their looks from head to toe. And I go, boy, you know what? I would love by the time I'm 80 to feel that. And it's just really interesting.
A story now that may have been lost amid all the news over the last month. In early October, the Trump administration declined to list the Pacific walrus as endangered, a decision that a conservation group called a death sentence for the species. Walruses are dependent on sea ice, which is declining as a result of climate change. We're joined now by Chad Jay, who leads the Walrus Research Program at the Alaska Science Center of the U.S. Geological Survey. He joins us from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage. Chad, is there an estimate for how many Pacific walruses there are right now?
Well, the last survey that was done was in 2006 with an estimate of about 130,000 animals, but that was known to be an incomplete survey.
Do we have a sense of the trend lines of what's happening to the Pacific walrus populations?
Yeah. Some more recent modeling work that's done by USGS suggests that the population underwent a rapid decline from the early 80s, and that decline slowed in the 90s. And at this point, it's not entirely clear whether the population is slowly increasing or slowly decreasing.
Well, what was the reason for that rapid decrease?
Well, we're not real sure, but it did fall on the heels of some very high harvest levels in the late 70s and early 80s. And whether the loss of sea ice that they've been experiencing over the last decade or two has had much to do with that is really unknown at this point.
Well, make the connection for us between walruses and sea ice. Why is sea ice so important to them?
Well, walruses use sea ice to breed in the wintertime and then to give birth in the spring. And they use sea ice also as a platform to crawl out onto and rest between feeding bouts on the seafloor. And with the sea ice over the shallow waters of the continental shelf, it allows walruses to access a great deal of area and occupy areas they want to be that's closest to their food sources. Right now, what we're seeing is in their summer range up in the Chukchi Sea that in late summer and early fall that the sea ice has been receding so rapidly and to such a large extent that it doesn't cover that shallow area anymore. And so walruses then are forced to use land haulouts to rest between their feeding bouts.
So will there come a point when these walruses won't be able to cope if sea ice continues to decline and, you know, waters get warmer and glaciers melt?
They are coping to some extent. It's hard to say how well they'll cope into the future. Sea ice model projections indicate that the sea ice decline is going to continue through the end of the centuries. And so a good deal of their habitat is still going to be lost in the future. And so it's really hard to say how well they're going to deal with that as conditions get worse.
What about some of the other effects of climate change? I mean, how are they being affected by things like warming waters and ocean acidification?
Walruses feed on the seafloor, and one of their main prey items are clams. And ocean acidification isn't good for animals that have to make shells. And so it's really too early to say how ocean acidification is going to play out into the future and how it might impact the prey for walruses. But also reduced sea ice also has an effect on how food gets to the bottom to these other marine organisms that walruses feed on. Hmm. So it could have some implications to their food source in the future.
How does it impact that?
Well, it's all about the kind of the timing of the sea ice melt and the amount of sunlight that gets into the water and creates a production that eventually falls to the bottom for these organisms to feed on. Another thing that's been observed with these walruses coming to shore to haul out is that they're further away from some of their preferred feeding grounds when they have to haul out onto shore. And so they have to travel greater distances. And so that has some energetic cost, but we're still trying to determine what the level of that cost is at the population level. Also, in these herds that form on land, they're very large herds sometimes, in the tens of thousands of animals, females and their young. And when they're on land, they're exposed to greater chances of disturbance from planes or boats or bears or human activities, and cause the walruses to stampede and trample some of the young to death at times.
So do you think that the decision not to list the Pacific walruses as endangered is going to have a noticeable impact on the animals?
I don't think I can comment on that at this point, and it's not appropriate for me to comment on it.
Because you're working at the U.S. Geological Survey.
Yes, right. Yes. We're a science organization, so we provide the science for federal, state, and local managers and the public and decision makers, and we don't make policies.
That's Chad Jay, who leads the Walrus Research Program at the Alaska Science Center of the U.S. Geological Survey. Chad, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And you can see these beautiful animals at hereandnow.org. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.